Good afternoon, and welcome to the October 2017 InfoTech Threat Landscape Briefing. My name is TJ Minicello, and I am a Senior Director in our Security and Threat Intelligence practice. I will be facilitating today's briefing. During today's discussion, we will cover topics related to cybersecurity, threat actor campaigns, regulatory compliance and legal issues, and threat actor exploits and tactics. Our cybersecurity section covers high-level topics such as threat trends, data breaches, control strategies, and exposure to vulnerabilities that will broaden your understanding of the cybersecurity impact on your business. Our threat actor campaign section covers topics related to nation-states, cybercriminals, and hacktivists, orchestrating campaigns designed to compromise networks and exfiltrate sensitive data. Our regulatory compliance and legal section covers trends in the global regulatory and legal landscape with the potential to impact compliance adherences or disrupt business operations. And lastly, our exploitation and tactics section provides information related to the tools, tactics, and exploits threat actors are leveraging in their attack campaigns. Today's briefing will also be supported by Associate Director Jessica Ireland, Research Managers Celine Gravelins and Philippe De Sousa, Senior Consulting Analyst Cameron Smith, and Consulting Analyst Ian Mulholland. During today's briefing, we will cover topics related to recent hurricane cyber scams, building blocks for a threat hunting function, a view into the threat actor Marcus Hutchings, the author of the Kronos malware, an update on the Equifax breach, new NIST ransomware guidance, and an overview of the Dragonfly Industrial Control System malware. I would now like to pass the presentation over to Celine, who will cover our first topic.
The 2017 summer fun was cut short for many people living in the Caribbean and southern U.S., as this year's hurricane season was one of the worst seen in years. Towards the end of August, Hurricane Harvey, a Category 5, hit the U.S. as the first major hurricane to make landfall in the U.S. since Wilma hit in 2005. It ended a 12-year record in which no hurricanes of this intensity had actually made landfall in the U.S. The majority of the damage was in Texas, as well as Louisiana and parts of the Caribbean. It resulted in 84 confirmed deaths, and economic losses were estimated to be between $70 and $200 billion. Just as Harvey was finally getting under control, Hurricane Irma was picking up speed. It devastated countries in the Caribbean as it made landfall as a Category 5, impacting countries such as Barbuda and the Virgin Islands, among others. It hit the Florida Keys and western Florida, causing significant damage. This hurricane resulted in 124 deaths by the end of September. When tragic events hit, society tends to pull together to help those affected. It can bring out the best in people as they're willing to donate money, supplies, and even time and effort to help clean up. There exist many legitimate charities and organizations accepting these donations to help the victims, but at the same time, it's crucial to be aware of the criminals who will use these disasters to their advantage. It's not a new phenomenon, but given the impact and publicity that these hurricanes had, scam relief funds seem to be popping up successfully. They might be in the form of a website claiming to represent a fake charity and collecting donations electronically through PayPal, or online forms simply collecting personally identifiable information, such as names, addresses, and birthdays. It may even be a webpage with the logo and title of a legitimate charity, but these funds are never actually given to that charity. Social media pages can have links to these websites and forums, preying on unsuspecting people. The social media page is legitimate, but remember that anyone can post to it, so that doesn't mean that the links are legitimate as well. Also, be cautious of malicious emails being sent out by people claiming to represent a charity. These can easily be typical phishing emails containing malicious links or harmful file attachments. The FTC, US CERT, and Department of Homeland Security, among others, have issued warnings of these opportunist criminals setting up means to steal donations and information from well-intentioned people. While it seems audacious that people could stoop this low, it's not uncommon for this to happen during times of tragedy. So much of this advice is broadly applicable after any catastrophe. Never assume that it's above people to take advantage of others at their most vulnerable. Whenever you're interested in donating to those in need or for any cause, make sure you research the organization who will be accepting the donation. Are they a registered charity listed on the National Charity Directory? Does it have a legitimate website? Even if so, check the date that it was created. As a result of these hurricanes, some websites were actually created overnight simply to seem more legitimate. For any charity, does it actually document how the funds are being used? You likely want to know where your money is going and how it's being used. Keep in mind, there is almost always some overhead costs associated with charities, but make sure you support the use and breakdown of how the donations are allocated. In the end, it's your money, so make sure you're comfortable with where it's going. And whenever tragedies hit, be cautious of opening emails from groups claiming to be collecting funds for victims. You might see links on social media pages, you might receive email attachments from what looks like a trusted source, but these could very well be malicious. Employ strong email and internet security practices by never opening those attachments or clicking those links, but by going to trusted websites that you type in yourself and that you've researched yourself. And as always, keep your security controls, like your antivirus and firewalls, up to date and patched. By following these recommendations, we can be more confident in helping those in need and making a positive difference in the world.
Active collaboration and information sharing is an important component of any security program in order to protect the organization against the next cyber threat. Threat collaboration is the integration and sharing of threat data between an organization's security operations, vulnerability management, incident response, and threat intelligence functions. Security operators are focused on the evaluation and escalation of security events to an incident management function. Incident responders manage the incident analysis and investigation process and coordinate with teams to respond and recover from incidents. Vulnerability management staff actively scan the environment to identify and remediate vulnerabilities. A threat intelligence function provides context into the next cyber threat and identify specific threat actor campaigns impacting the organization. Organizations must look at security with a holistic mindset. Threat hunting is another function within a security program that is designed to augment existing security protection activities. Threat hunting is a part of what InfoTech calls a threat collaboration environment, where members must actively collaborate to address cyber threats affecting the organization's brand, business operation, and technology infrastructure on a daily basis. All teams focus on different aspects of protecting the organization and must collaborate to help fill each other's intelligence gaps. Many organizations today are trying to define and implement a threat hunting function. A recent SAN survey revealed that nearly 86% of organizations are involved in some form of threat hunting. In order to properly design and implement a threat hunting function, organizations should follow a structured program management methodology consisting of various planning, analysis, scenario development, execution, and reporting activities. During the planning phase, organizations should work within the threat collaboration environment to develop a plan, evaluate tools to be used during the threat hunting project, assign roles and responsibilities, and decide if the project will be executed with either in-house or third-party resources. During the analysis phase, teams should analyze unresolved suspicious activities to aid in scenario development. Scenario development should consist of the development of a threat hypothesis, which will drive the execution of the threat hunting project. The threat hunting function should develop multiple threat scenarios and create a threat hunting project portfolio that will be executed over a defined time frame. In order to properly execute a threat hunting project, staff should be provided with dedicated time to execute the scenario. The threat hunting function should design a cadence of reporting hunting findings. In addition, an escalation protocol should be put in place when critical findings are identified that cause a significant impact to the business and should be treated as an incident. Threat hunting reporting and indicators of compromise should be structured in an analytical framework such as the Lockheed Martin kill chain. The kill chain is designed to structure analysis into various phases of an attack lifecycle. Reconnaissance will identify organizational external exposures that a threat actor could leverage to orchestrate the initial phase of an attack campaign. Weaponization consists of the identification of vulnerabilities and tools that could be or were used to execute the attack campaign. Delivery is the understanding of how the threat actor was able to introduce malware or other cyber weapons into the environment. Exploitation is the analysis of how the malware or other cyber tool was able to exploit a weakness in cyber defenses. Installation is the understanding of how the threat actor is able to maintain persistent access to the environment. Command and control is the identification of traffic between the environment and the threat actor infrastructure. And action on objectives is understanding the motive and intent of the cyber attack campaign. A successful threat hunting program enriches threat data and contributes not only towards organizational situational awareness, but provides better context into the larger threat landscape. Organizations that implement a formal threat hunting function should benefit from gaining better visibility into unknown threats, resulting in a more proactive security program. When considering the implementation of a threat hunting function, organizations should build a program charter, plan, and dedicate staff to the threat hunting program. Create an analyst exchange platform where core threat collaboration environment staff can exchange analysis about hunting topics to aid in scenario development. Align threat hunting projects with the organization's threat intelligence collection plan. Enroll management, security operations, threat intelligence, incident response, and vulnerability management into the threat hunting program. I would like to pass the presentation over to Ian, who will cover our next topic.
By now you might be quite familiar with the name Marcus Hutchins, also known as Malware Tech, a name that has been making headlines throughout the summer. Marcus Hutchins is the hero responsible for identifying the kill switch for the WannaCry ransomware that hit over 300,000 computers across more than 150 countries back in May of this year. Hutchins discovered the kill switch by accident while reverse engineering samples of the WannaCry ransomware just days after it began to spread all over the world. Additionally, for several years, Hutchins has been the author of Malware Tech, a popular cybersecurity blog that provides readers with information on relevant issues in the cybersecurity space. In early August of this year, the FBI arrested Marcus Hutchins in Las Vegas while he was attending a hacking conference. The FBI believed that Hutchins authored and/or sold a malicious program called Kronos back in 2014 and 2015. Kronos is a piece of malware that attempts to steal banking information from the victim. Kronos is a type of Trojan and is therefore most often distributed through email, where the malware can easily pretend to be something innocent, like an email attachment. This banking Trojan first appeared for sale in 2014 on AlphaBay, a dark web marketplace that was later shut down in 2017 by a coordinated global law enforcement raid. Selling for $7,000, this expensive piece of malware comes with an impressive list of features. In addition to allowing the user to grab the victim's login credentials and other banking details, the malware offers multiple modules for flying under the radar, according to the IBM researchers who discovered the malware. Kronos could also change the banking web pages being viewed by the victim in an attempt to gain additional information from the victim. Hutchins could face a maximum sentence of 40 years in prison if found guilty on all 6 accounts against him. Many faithful Mauertek followers quickly came to Hutchins' aid after he was arrested, claiming that the evidence against him was insufficient. So far, they have donated more than $14,000 to his defense fund. These followers have also attempted to gather evidence supporting that Hutchins did not author Kronos, including bringing a post to the public's attention that shows Hutchins asking if anybody had a copy of Kronos for him to have a look at. According to Bank Info Security, the following is the evidence against Marcus Hutchins. Statements made by Hutchins after he was arrested, a CD containing 2 audio recordings from a county jail in Nevada where he was detained by the FBI, 150 pages of jabber chats between the defendant and an individual, business records from Apple, Google, and Yahoo, statements, 350 pages, by the defendant from another internet forum, which were seized by the government in another district, 3 to 4 samples of malware, and a search warrant executed on a third party, which may contain some privileged information. A detailed investigative report created by Curbs on Security looked into the past activity of Marcus Hutchins. The final report suggests that Marcus Hutchins did have a successful black hat career for several years, but at least mostly left malicious coding behind in 2013. This report was not able to provide any evidence for or against Hutchins authoring or selling the Kronos software. Many claim that he left his black hat activity behind and instead focus on dissecting, analyzing, and reporting the malware created by others. I will now pass it over to Jessica to cover the next topic.
And now on to the highly publicized Equifax breach. So what is Equifax for those who aren't familiar? Equifax is a consumer credit reporting agency, which means they hold highly sensitive information on over 800 million individuals and 88 million businesses all over the world. This breach was bait for the media, as it should be. Equifax touts their identity theft protection solution, but here they stand, another casualty of a data breach. So what happened? Early September, the company announced, after 41 days of waiting after the actual attack happened, allegedly late May, early July, that thieves had made off with 145.5 million social security numbers, dates of birth, names, addresses, and about 209,000 credit card numbers from its files. To give the attack some perspective about the amount of people this touched, over 44% of the U.S. population will be affected in the coming years. So what's happening now? Users are still not getting a clear picture about whether their particular data has been affected by this breach or any third parties with contracts with Equifax. Equifax is saying that the, quote, core credit reporting databases were unaffected, but that does little to make people feel reassured. It's believed the breach occurred through an exploitation of a vulnerability that open source server software disclosed earlier in September. This means that Equifax is now on the line for not engaging in proper security practices. There are 4 hearings planned as Congress determines what really happened to have this breach occur. Critics are saying that Equifax should have known better than to leave their open source software unsupported and/or out of date. Hightech Bridge CEO and founder Ilya Kolochenko called the breach, quote, a very colorful, albeit very sad, example of how a vulnerability in a web application can lead to disastrous consequences for an entire company, its customer base, and far beyond. Undoubtedly, the cost to Equifax's reputation and customer relationships is almost immeasurable. Alex Smith, Director of Security Products at Intermedia, argues that the Equifax breach will, quote, have wide-reaching implications for how Americans identify themselves in the future, such as when applying for banking and credit services. Simply knowing a name, date of birth, address, and social security number shouldn't ever be enough, he said to SC Magazine, adding, this breach could finally be the security wake-up call the U.S. needs to widely adopt digital identity tokens and potentially a digital national identity scheme similar to other countries such as Belgium. And while the breach itself was unfortunate, the delay in notifying customers is equally, if not more, questionable. The company may not be compliant to data breach state laws and may have made things difficult for themselves for international standards like GDPR coming in 2018. GDPR requires much faster data breach notification, like 72 hours after a breach is discovered. If you're someone who signed up for Equifax's free year of credit monitoring and identity theft protection, you may want to consider paying for those services once Equifax's free year is up. This is because attackers tend to be aware of this one-year free deal and hold data for more than a year, starting to really play with it even at 3 years after the initial theft of data. Since Equifax hasn't really clarified whether or not you should be worried, definitely keep an eye out on your own finances for any abnormal behavior. Stay aware of your own credit report and activity, and stay up to date in the news, especially as the Congress hearings keep moving forward.
Back in September, the National Cybersecurity Center of Excellence, with NIST, released their guidelines on ransomware recovery. While still currently a draft, these new guidelines are their special publication 1800-11C, entitled Data Integrity, Recovering from Ransomware and Other Destructive Events. Of course, this means that the scope is beyond just ransomware alone and expands on how to recover from various threats that could affect the integrity of information. These guidelines are split up into three separate volumes. Volume A, an executive summary. Volume B, approach, architecture, and security characteristics. And Volume C, how-to guides. While any of these volumes can be consumed by most security professionals, NIST does suggest specific audiences for the different volumes. Volume A will be useful for business decision makers who want to understand benefits and challenges of data integrity. Volume B will be useful for any security managers looking to learn more so about assessing and mitigating risk, while Volume C will be useful for IT professionals looking to implement the approach that is used within the overall guidelines. These guidelines provide a great example of how to build a security architecture, the corresponding reference design, and then a deeper dive into how to do this all. The security architecture, in particular, consists of five components, which are secure storage, referring to retention and storage of information with security measures such as encryption, logging, referring to the collection and aggregation of all log sources within the organization to be able to identify root causes of data integrity incidents, virtual infrastructure, referring to the management of virtual machines and instances, which help with backup and restoration capabilities. Corruption testing, referring to the review of data to ensure that no malicious or unwarranted modifications or even deletions take place to the data. And lastly, backup capability, referring to the backup function relating to areas that are not covered by the virtual infrastructure mentioned above. In this architecture, the components are not mutually exclusive, as we'll see many of the same security technologies and solutions can be used to meet the shared goal of the different component areas. This can be seen more closely in the reference design shown here, which demonstrates how the physical machines, virtual machines, and databases will interact with multiple different components from the architecture. What makes this publication different from many of those that we see from NIST is that these guidelines are more actionable and provide specific detailed guidance on how to prepare better for data integrity incidents and how to recover from them more easily. In the past, NIST has focused on the high-level items that need to be completed, but doesn't necessarily get into the details of how exactly to do this. In this special publication, we are seeing specific advice on how to build some of the security architecture to respond to data integrity attacks with existing products on the market. Particularly, this is noted in Volume C, which provides detailed how-to guides for setting up the various security products that were used. These are not your typical installation guides, as the vendors themselves are able to provide that, but instead describe how the different security technologies can interact with one another in the goal of easy recovery from data integrity attacks. One item to note is that the guidelines do go into specific vendors and products that were used for developing their recovery architecture. On the one hand, this is helpful as it gives guidance on how to use these tools to its fullest potential, but on the other, it should be reminded that these are not the only solutions that can be used. Within the document, there is the disclaimer that states that this is not a form of endorsement for these vendors, but it should still give pause to any practitioner using this guide. Instead of seeing these solutions as the only option available, remember to perform your due diligence by looking at other products with similar functionality. As a note, this guideline explicitly states that it does not necessarily meet any regulatory compliance, including NIST 853. While there is some mapping of 853 controls to some of the ones mentioned in these guidelines, it is solely there for reference. Overall, these guidelines are meant to be a resource for dealing with recovery concerns that may arise. This is also still a draft of the publication, so feedbacks and comments are still welcome until the beginning of November. Take a look right now as it is publicly available and leverage it to the needs of your organization.
Hello, and thank you for joining the exploitation and tactics portion of our briefing. My name is Cameron Smith, and today we will be discussing the Dragonfly malware that recently targeted industrial control systems of energy companies in Europe and the United States. In the context of this attack, Dragonfly refers to the hacker group to which the malware has been attributed. Also known under the pseudonym Energetic Bear, the Dragonfly group is a well-known and well-resourced Russian hacker group. The primary vector for exploitation in this case was through a compromised third-party partner of energy companies who was providing software updates to industrial control systems. In this case, a Trojan horse called backdoor.oldre, which is known to be a signature tool of the Dragonfly or Energetic Bear group, was injected into an otherwise legitimate software update for the industrial control systems. There was a second Trojan that was used in a small proportion of the attacks called Trojan.karagani. Capabilities of these two pieces of malware include gathering information on the infected systems, downloading and uploading files, and providing the ability to execute arbitrary code on the target device. No evidence has yet been made public to show that these infected systems were actually exploited to exfiltrate any significant data or to cause any significant sabotage of the target energy companies. However, the extent to which these critical systems was compromised is alarming and should serve as a warning shot to threat actors have the ability to infiltrate these critical systems. Furthermore, this infiltration, plus the recent exposure with the CCleaner product, both highlight that legitimate software providers are an active attack vector for bad actors, and due diligence must be done to verify that system updates are indeed genuine, even from trusted providers. Lastly, it is strongly suspected that energy companies were not the initial target of this attack. Further post-mortem research has indicated that update providers are primarily servicing pharmaceutical companies. If the energy companies were the real target, a different vector may likely have been chosen. Again, this should serve as evidence to all organizations that you can be the victim of an attack without knowing that you are a target for attackers, or indeed may not even be the intended target of an attacker, but still be compromised. We have identified three particular mitigations for this attack, including ensuring that antivirus and IDPS signatures are up to date, and that they are specifically including in signatures for backdoor.oldre, Trojan.karagani, and for the web attack Lights Out. Secondly, engage with third-party software update providers or any other managed service providers to ensure that they are following best security practices. Lastly, a defense-in-depth approach to security is always prudent. Requiring administrative privileges to run executables will provide an additional point of control in the case that malware is able to get past your defenses. As always, leveraging threat intelligence tools and programs will always help to stay informed of the latest threat actors and exploits. If you'd like to hear more about this topic or to discuss mitigations in further detail, we'd be happy to schedule a call with one of our analysts.
This concludes our October 2017 threat briefing. Included in today's presentation were several hyperlinks to our research blueprints that you can use to address some of the threats presented during today's briefing. If you have any questions or need any support, please do not hesitate to contact us and set up an analyst call. Thank you.